I'd like to call to order. We have microphone. All right, very good. I'd like to call to order the Committee of Senate for Health and Human Services for Monday, March 12th. I apologize for starting a little late. Our session, floor session, ran a little bit longer than we anticipated. We do have a very full agenda today. It is not, let's say it's probably questionable that we'll get everything done in our normal time here this afternoon. So we are planning to do as much as we can and then recess and come back at, I believe, 6:30. Is that? Six o'clock. So we will plan to recess and return at about 6 o'clock this evening. First on the agenda, we're going to hear from Senator Cruz, Senate File 2173. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I guess with your permission, I do have a author's amendment, if it would be prudent to offer that at this time.
Senator Cruz, let's see. We're getting that amendment distributed, so why don't you go ahead and start to describe the bill as it would be amended, and then as soon as we get the I'm not sure if we have a quorum yet either, so we'll assume that as an author's amendment that we will adopt this, and maybe you can just begin to discuss the bill.
Fantastic, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 2173 is a bill concerning automated drug distribution systems. Essentially what this would do is currently there are many long-term care facilities and different groups that are using automated drug machines, drug dispensing machines. These facilities are required to ask for a variance every year to continue to do that. What this legislation would do is kind of clarify some current statute and allow them to do this on a more regular basis without having to ask for that variance. The benefits here are first and foremost security. Currently for facilities that do not utilize systems like this, when you go to a pharmacy and you get a prescription filled, you have these large punch cards that sometimes, depending on whether a prescription would change or not be needed anymore, would leave an excess of medication. That opens up potential for theft or wrong use. This would help take care of that. Secondly, what this is going to help do is help distribute medication in a timely fashion. Because these machines are on site and they do one dose at a time distribution, that cuts down on the waste and time needed to get the medication to the patients. And then thirdly, this cuts down on cost. Obviously, if you have a prescription that changes and you have these cards out there that have this excess of medication, that gets thrown away, and that's waste. So with that, today I have Jesse Androff to testify and kind of walk through a little bit more of the bill and describe it in a bit more detail.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Before we do that, we do have a quorum, and so let's perhaps we could ask Senator Hoffman to move the A1 delete all amendment to Senate File 2173 as an author's amendment. And
so moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. So now we have the bill amended to your wishes, Senator Cruz. And Ms. Androff, are you going to testify first?
One more. Senator Cruz. Quick thing, Mr. Chairman and members, we do have one brief oral amendment, and I know we moved it already, so maybe we could just make this oral amendment to the bill as is, if staff would be so kind as to describe that oral amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, on the A1 amendment, on page 1, line 16, after the semicolon, insert or. On line 17, delete that semicolon and insert a period, and then delete line 18.
All right.
So we're basically taking correctional facilities out of the bill.
Members, clear on what we've done. This is the A1 amendment that has been become now the bill, line 16 and 17 and 18. And Senator Lori moves the oral amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Amendment added. Senator Cruz, any other comments before we turn to your witnesses?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Androff, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Androff. I am a pharmacist, and I am Director of Pharmacy Operations at Merwin LTC Pharmacy, and I'm asking for your support of Senate Bill 2173. The bill, as amended, allows for automated drug distribution systems to be used in skilled nursing facilities, housing services establishments that provide centralized storage of medications, community behavioral health hospitals, and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program facilities operated by the Department of Human Services. This does not affect automated drug distribution systems in hospitals where they're currently used. Traditional dispensing systems in these populations use blister cards, as Senator Cruz was referring to, with up to a month supply or more of medication. These blister cards are delivered from a central pharmacy and can take hours or days to arrive from the central pharmacy. Automated drug distribution systems located at a healthcare facility offer the following benefits when compared to traditional dispensing systems. Control of drugs. Greatly improved control and accountability when compared to traditional drug dispensing systems. Each dose is accounted for, including controlled substances. Number two, increased availability of drugs. On-site drug availability for newly admitted residents and new or changed orders for current residents. Automated drug distribution systems result in exponentially faster access to much-needed antibiotics, pain medications, and end-of-life medications, instead of waiting for a delivery from the central pharmacy that could take hours. As a result, patients are treated faster and the risk for rehospitalization is less. This leads to better patient care. Fewer medication errors. Reduce potential for error and confusion when medication packages are available on a MedPass by MedPass basis as compared to hundreds of blister cards in a medication cart. Automated drug distribution systems reduce the sheer volume of medications that medication administration staff is required to handle during each MedPass because the doses from these systems are only for that MedPass. Number four, reduced pharmaceutical waste. Pharmaceutical waste in these settings is unavoidable using traditional dispensing systems. In automated drug distribution systems, medications are filled daily or for a specific MedPass. Changed or discontinued medications or medications for discharged or deceased residents are not wasted. The best way to reduce waste is to not create it. Number five, cost savings. All payers receive the benefit of being charged only for the doses used. If a medication is discontinued or changed, only the doses used are charged to Medicare or Medicaid, not an entire month's supply as in traditional dispensing systems. Number six, reduce drug diversion. Medications are available only one dose at a time and are completely tracked in the system instead of an entire month's worth of medication on a blister card being available to be diverted. Number seven, better quality care. Medication administration personnel and nursing staff spend less time ordering and prepping medications, allowing for more time spent assisting and caring for the population that they serve. Additional time can be spent with the resident, resulting in higher quality patient care, which is really paramount in these settings. I request your support of Senate Bill 2173, which would allow automated drug distribution systems to be utilized in these underserved populations in Minnesota and greatly improve resident care, decrease waste, and decrease cost. I'd be happy to answer any questions that arise.
Thank you, Ms. Androff. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Senator Cruz, Mr. Goodnow, want to offer testimony as well?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just here in case there are any questions.
Is there any questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to one of the testifiers, maybe, you know, I work in the industry, so I understand about this and how the industry works. And maybe I missed it in your testimony when I was reading, but could you just explain how it's currently done now? I think, you know, there's a lot of members here that have never seen the behind the scenes of what we have to do. So if you could explain that.
Ms. Androff?
Thank you, Chair. Senator Hoffman, currently in most of these facilities that are served by this, there is a blister card of medication. It's approximately the size of a half a sheet of paper. It has multiple bubbles, they're called, in them, and there is foil backing. So pills are dispensed one tablet or one dose per bubble, and the nursing staff is required to punch them out into a dosing cup to give to the resident. For an average resident of a skilled nursing facility, they're having at least 10 of their medications on a scheduled basis. So for an average-sized nursing facility of about 100 beds, multiply that by at least 10 blister cards, you can see the sheer volume of blister cards that staff would be required to shuffle through. And the downside is that anytime any of those medications are discontinued, the remainder can be considered waste or be available for diversion.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. The first is, why did we take correctional facilities out of the bill?
Ms. Sandra.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Higgins, correctional facilities will be required to go through judiciary. And so at this time.
At least you're honest. Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
Then, Mr. Chair, my other question is on the last sentence of the bill. And there's a phrase talking about the pharmacist on duty within the managing pharmacy, which is probably going to be not on location, must be continuously available to address any problems deterred by the monitoring and to answer questions from the staff. Number one, are the managing pharmacies staffed 24 hours a day? So if something happened in the non-traditional working hours, this could be possible. And second, I don't understand what problems, I'm questioning the word deterred. I'm not sure deterred is the right word there.
Ms. Androff or Mr. Goodnow?
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Goodnow, I'm here on behalf of Merwin. Senator Higgins, you're very good and very good reader there. It should be detected rather than deterred.
That makes more sense. Okay.
And Mr. Goodnow, to the other question that Senator Higgins asked about availability 24 hours a day, is that your question?
Are the managing pharmacies open 24 hours a day?
Ms. Androff?
Senator Higgins, yes. Currently, our pharmacy is operating 24/7, as are a lot of the types of pharmacies that service these types of patient populations. I can't speak for every pharmacy, but I can speak for mine.
Thank you.
All right, and I think Sir Higgins would like to move an amendment, oral amendment, to line 3.11 to delete the word deterred and replaced with the word detected. All in favor of the oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Senator Cruz, other testimony at this point?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Are there other questions from members of the committee? Senator Cruz, I don't believe that anybody has requested the bill. Other, now that the amendment has been made with respect to correctional facilities, I've got no request to be heard in any other committee. And so would your wish be to move this to the floor?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Senator Newman moves that Senate File 2173 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Cruz, and witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next on our agenda, we're going to take up Senate File 1824. We've got a little less than an hour, and we have a significant number of witnesses on this bill, and so I do not believe we'll be taking action on this until we reconvene after recess. So I just want to put people on alert to that. We want to give people an opportunity to present testimony and just to make you aware of that. So the other bills on the agenda will likely be pushed off till this evening. And if anybody's here just for those particular bills, I apologize for not being able to get everything in our first session here. But that's the way that it looks like it's going to work. So, Senator Nenow, Senate File 1824.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1824 is an attempt to assure that we have some transparency and accountability in our Medicaid programs. Currently, we contract those out to managed care organizations, HMOs, and there's questions that have arisen that some people have had about where does that money go? Does it get down to the end recipient in the term, in the sense that are people getting the appropriate level of care? Are providers receiving appropriate levels of reimbursements, et cetera, et cetera? This piece of legislation essentially has three bullet points to it. Number one, it is a requirement of an annual independent third-party audit. Number two, in order to effectively do that, would need to involve access at a high level of granular encounter data so that we can see not that Mrs. Jones had ankle surgery, but how many ankle surgeries and how much was paid for those, et cetera. And then the third item is a prohibition on the actuary who works for the state of Minnesota also contracting with the plans as their actuary so that you don't have the same entity on both sides of the negotiating table, as it were. That is the bill in its high-level form. Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment just to get the bill tweaked up, if I could offer at this time the A1 amendment before we get into any testimony.
I think we're having that distributed right now.
And while that's being distributed, Mr. Chair, I'll just briefly explain.
Sure, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, the first portion of this amendment, the CPAs came to me and said maybe the language on which entities might be eligible to do the auditing, maybe that language is a little too tight and we might be cutting them out. So we included some language here to be more accommodating there. If the CPAs are reading this, we did change the language a little bit to what they had proposed to me. It includes a three-year look-back where any audit firm that is doing this auditing cannot have worked with any of the plans for the previous 3 years. The idea there to keep an arm's length to eliminate any potential conflicts or concerns with and for the firm that would be doing the auditing. And the last part of this is dealing with the fiscal note and trying to get that eliminated. That's the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we can treat this as an author's amendment. Senator Nenow moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1824. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Mr. Chair, I know you said there's a number of people that want to testify on this bill. I don't have the list of who those might be. So if you want to just have testimony and then we can have discussion maybe after that.
All right. I'll go down my list. I have first Michelle Barrett.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Michelle Barrett. I am the attorney and lobbyist for the Minnesota Podiatric Medical Association, consisting of the podiatric physicians and surgeons in the state of Minnesota. We thank you, Senator Nenow, and members of this committee for the extensive bipartisan support of this bill that is not only occurring in the Senate, but has also occurred in the House as well. I'm here to speak about the serious problems with the Medicaid reimbursement to providers, specifically the podiatric physicians and surgeons in Minnesota. I believe that over the years and my 30 years of lobbying for this association, this is an increasing problem that is now at a crisis level, and I believe that this bill is a start in the right direction to look at the problems. One podiatrist at our board meeting recently reported that he received for two different claims a $7 reimbursement for the Medicaid patient, and the second claim was reimbursed at $9. That hardly seems possible, but believe me, it's true. In just a two-year period of time, we had a podiatrist report that his Medicaid reimbursements for several procedures that he performed was literally cut in half by 50% over the last 2 years. Then, additionally, he saw reimbursement for x-rays and other diagnostic tests decreased by 50% as well over a 2-year period of time. When the podiatrist performed these procedures at these types of reimbursement levels, they are basically providing the services to these Medicaid patients free of charge. And that is taking into account the physician time to perform the medical procedure, the cost of the staff assistance, and the overhead to process the paperwork for the Medicaid reimbursement. When you add on top of that diagnostic procedures and tests, some podiatrists are paying several hundred dollars out of their pocket to see the Medicaid patient. If the health plans have certified in their rates to the federal government over the many years that they have paid podiatrists more than they have in fact reimbursed them, then this is a serious problem that needs to be addressed. I believe that this bill, through the independent audit, will investigate this problem. And I do believe that in the past few weeks, United States Senator Grassley, Congresswoman Bachman, Senator Amy Klobuchar have all joined in the request to have independent audits of the health plans for the Medicaid rates. We commend you for taking up this legislation. We appreciate that these issues will be looked into further, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions for the witness? Next on my list, I have David Feinwachs.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Dave Feinwachs. I am a resident of the city of St. Paul. This particular issue of transparency and accountability in these public programs has been of some interest to me for the last couple of years, and I believe that this proposal is a long-needed first step and a modest first step in addressing some of the problems that we have. And I also believe it's important to recognize that the intent of this legislation, I do not believe, is to in any way interfere with private enterprise or business. One of the serious issues that we have to address is whether or not the management of these public programs is in fact the same thing as the business of the sale of commercial insurance, and whether commingling of funds or management techniques is in fact required or voluntary on the part of programs. And, of course, what we are suggesting is to the extent that we're looking at public money, entirely public money funding these public programs, everyone, providers, taxpayers, policymakers alike, have a right and an obligation to know exactly what's going on. And this measure would basically provide that needed transparency. I urge you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I have Dominic Sposetto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dominic Sposetto. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Dental Association. We're in support of Senate File 1824. I appear today representing dentists as health care providers and small business people. We're not accountants. We don't really understand how large contracts with health plans work, and we're not totally sure we understand the whole PMAP system. But what we do know is that the system, from the dental standpoint, appears to be broken. And there's a tremendous amount of frustration and even anger on the part of the dental community in this state related to the dental care system that we provide for our state program recipients. Over the last 3 years, we've seen sort of a major destruction of what we consider to be our dental safety net. We've cut adult dental benefits rather dramatically. We have a very limited dental benefit set now, which really seriously affects patient care to this population. And we've got to the position where the emergency room is the dental office of choice for many of our Medicaid and Minnesota care recipients. We've been cutting reimbursements rather substantially. In the last year, we cut reimbursements by 3%. And I know many of you have been around for a while, and you've heard the issue of dental reimbursements, the fact that dentists are paid about 35 cents on the dollar for the services they provide to state government programs, and that is woefully inadequate, doesn't cover their overhead. And keep in mind that any time you go into a dental office, you're actually going into a mini hospital operatory. It's it's considered a surgical procedure because of the sterilization of equipment, infection control, the gloves, all the materials that are involved in that make dental care in some cases a little more expensive to provide than just going to your physician or going to other health care providers. So each procedure is a surgical procedure, and we have to treat it as such, and it gets to be expensive. So I'm not saying that this bill does anything to deal with the reimbursement issue, and that's been an ongoing situation, but it's gotten worse instead of getting better. And then lastly, we've removed all of the private practitioners in this state from our critical access provider program, which we set up several years ago to provide basically an increased reimbursement to those people that are continuing to do the safety net, that continue to see this population. You may know that many dentists around the state have chosen not to continue to provide services to this population, frankly, because of the reimbursement and the way the PEEPMAP system was set up, and just, again, their anger and frustration with the system. So I think what the issue is for many of them is that you cut services, you've eliminated private practice from part of the safety net, but yet at the same time we've seen rather significant growth in the profit / reserves / money, whatever you call it, that is going to the managed care plans to manage the system. And again, they're managing the system, and I'm not here to say whether they do a good job or a bad job. The point is that we'd like to make is that they're managing the system, but the people that are providing the actual care, the providers, are not receiving any of the benefits from their management. And we don't think that that's the way to go. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that we would like the state to take a strong look at how this system works, and we think the beginning is to look at an outside audit, an independent audit, to certify that the rates that they provide to providers is, one, adequate, and, two, most importantly, providing the access that they're contracted to provide. And I think that's, as it relates to dental care, I think that's a very, very important issue, because if you're providing them money on a capitated basis to provide dental care services and there aren't any providers in their network or in a facility or in a county, that could be an issue. And we've just noted just recently in southeastern Minnesota, one of the last large Medicaid providers quit the program because of the critical access withdrawal of funding. And based on that, we have one provider in five counties, and that includes Olmsted County. So it's not an underpopulated area. And we have one provider, and we're questioning whether that's adequate to provide the access to that population. So an independent audit to certify the rates, providing an assessment of the access they provide, especially for dental care, and then finally, I think, living up to the fiduciary responsibility that the state has to deal with these taxpayer dollars. So, Mr. Chairman, we would encourage you to support this legislation.
Thank you. I just want to be clear on does this bill, you mentioned the reimbursement rates that dentists receive, and I think that most of us would agree that the federal Medicaid programs and other programs are notorious for not paying sufficient funds to cover the costs, and that as a result of that, there has to be other mechanisms that people employ to shift those costs, the balance of them, to some other place to make sure that they come out fiscally solvent. Does this bill get at that problem of costs? Ma'am, I just want to be clear that if we pass this bill, would that solve the problem of costs that you're raising?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't believe it does. And if I understand your question correctly, you're probably talking about cost shifting?
Well,
The reimbursement level from the federal government or the state?
Well, the question that you're raising is that I think one that is, in my understanding, common to the whole Medicaid program is that there isn't sufficient money that the federal government provides to really reimburse people at their costs. And so you're raising that as a problem, and I'm just trying to understand if this bill gets at that problem.
Mr. Chairman, no, it does not address that problem, but it's also a joint responsibility of the state and the federal government. Frankly, the state sets the rates. Under the PMAP system, the contract between the plans and the dentists set the rates. The point I'm trying to make is that maybe under the system that the PMAP system is set up, that they would need to increase their rates to assure that they had enough dental providers in their network to provide the services. We don't know that. We don't have the information. We have an idea of what they pay in aggregate, but we don't really have enough information to make a case either way. So our thought is that once we get this information, and again, it probably wouldn't come directly to the dental community, it would come to you as legislators, then we could have that debate.
Thank you. Mr. Sposetto, are some of the members of your association, are they recipients of any, or participate in any fee-for-service programs directly for dental care?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Some participate in the DHS fee-for-service for the disabled population. Depending on the contracts that they have with various commercial providers, those are based on a fee-for-service system.
And what is the comparison between fee-for-service reimbursement for procedures versus the reimbursements that come through the plans? Are they the same, or is one higher or lower, or how would you characterize the for a similar procedure in a fee-for-service structure versus the managed care? What does the payment rate to dentists look like? Is it the same, or is one more than the other?
It depends on the individual contract. Depending if you are a small commercial carrier or a small plan, you probably pay what's called usual and customary fees, which are the fees that are generally submitted to you by the dental provider. If you're a large plan and you have a provider network that has a contract, you can provide fees that are discounted. They are based off of the fee schedule that's provided by the dentist to the plan, but then it is discounted as part of the contract. And that actually varies depending on the contract. For example, a state employee contract is generally a fee-for-service system, but it's discounted almost 20%. The point is that dental reimbursements aren't like that through the Medicaid system. They were set in statute back in 1982. The legislature decided in its wisdom that it should put these fees in statute. And so they were created in statute based on a historic fee structure. And that's gone on that way for many years. And when we migrated from the fee-for-service system to the PMAP system chose to use those fees because those were the fees that were built into Medicaid. So we started out woefully inadequate. And those fees are based on data submitted in 1982. To give you an idea of the data we're dealing with, is almost 30 years old. So, and the legislature hasn't increased that. So the statutory fee base for fee-for-service is set so low that the PMAP system, which does not necessarily have to use that, has chosen to use that. And in some cases, they'll pay more than the statutory fee-for-service system, a little bit more. But it's still woefully inadequate to set up a system where we can provide care. So what we're doing is basically giving the dentist the opportunity to choose whether they want to participate in this program. And those that have participated for years and years and years have not seen any increase in their reimbursements while their overhead and other services have increased. So they're deciding to no longer participate. And we're setting up a system that is based basically on community services, state-operated facilities, and others who get outside income through grants or other ways to participate, or critical access reimbursement because they're designated as nonprofits in this state to get the increased reimbursement, and they're continuing to provide those services. And some of those are on the ropes. So I don't have the answer, Mr. Chairman. I really don't. But I just wanted to share with you that we don't have the data. I don't think you have the data or the information necessary to make a decision on how you want to proceed. And hopefully this is a first step.
All right. Thank you. Are there other questions for the witness? Next I have on my list Dave Renner.
Chair and members, my name is Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association, approximately 10,000 physician members across the state. I will try to be brief. I'm hesitant, or considering changing some of my testimony to try to address some of your earlier questions, Mr. Chair, but we are in support of this bill and for basically three major issues. Before I go there, I do want to make it very clear, we are not saying we should get rid of the PMAP program. Matter of fact, our members do get paid a bit more under PMAP than we do under fee-for-service. The trouble is, as we understand it, most of the health plans use the fee-for-service payment that this legislature sets as the basis for that payment. When we started looking into this about 4 or 5 years ago, we were asking the health plans, could we get a better understanding what your payments are, and we were told that's proprietary information. So we were unable to gather that information. There was legislation that was passed 3 years ago, I believe, by the legislature to start some preliminary, to start some preliminary reports to the Department of Human Services to gather at least overall summary data on where those payments are going. The main reason we are supportive of this legislation is because we believe you as legislators have an obligation to have some oversight of where we are spending, where the money that you allocate to go to health care goes. And whenever we've tried to ask the Department of Human Services, they have not been able to provide that information. We've tried to ask the health plans, they have not been able to provide that information. So we believe that there is need for additional oversight so that you have a better understanding as policymakers where the money that you intend to go to health care is being spent. Similar to the other provider groups that have testified, the fee-for-service fee schedule for physician rates has not received across-the-board increase since 2000. And as Mr. Spizzetto said, those payments are based on median charges from back in 1989. So, as a matter of fact, the last 3 years, we have seen cuts to the fee-for-service fee schedule and the physician payments for non-primary care services. So if the health plans are using the fee-for-service fee schedule as the basis for their PMAP payments, those payments have also been flat or gone down, at least in some of the specialties. So, but again, back to the legislation, we think the importance of this legislation is to ensure some oversight, to provide some trust and some accountability back to our PMAP programs. And we would suggest that we may even want to go to the next step. And as part of that auditing system and that certification system, maybe we should also be looking at, are the payments that the health plans are making to providers adequate to ensure the access and to address the at least cover costs for providers? With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Renner. I guess a similar kind of question. The bill doesn't really get at that problem that you're raising, which I think is a significant problem. And I guess I'm trying to find out if the problem isn't more with the Medicaid structure or is it with the plans. It seems to be the argument is that we have this Medicaid process where we set rates and they're used for fee-for-service and they're used as the basis for the reimbursement rates through PMAP. And even though the PMAP rates seem to be slightly higher, maybe I'm not sure what the data is, but higher than the fee-for-service rates, still not enough. But I'm not sure how the bill gets at that problem unless, and maybe you can just clarify what the expectation is that this bill would do to address that problem.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. This bill does not address the overall, the underlying problem that the legislature in the past at least 12, 15 years has not funded the fee-for-service Medicaid program appropriately, the proper provider rates. What this bill, we think, does help us, though, is better understand that money you are appropriating, which is going up every year, is that being used for the services that you intended? And I would argue the services you intended was to fund hospital services, physician services, podiatry services, and other healthcare services. The data that we have today and what you have as policymakers, you have a hard time, I would argue, have a hard time understanding whether that money is really being used for those healthcare services or not. So what the bill just basically asks for is for a further oversight, further accountability in a sense that we make sure that those monies are being used where they go. Will this result in payments being increased to providers, this bill alone? No, it will not. But it will at least get you more data to when you make those decisions on where to appropriate future funds.
All right. Thank you. Are there other questions for the witness? Thank you, Mr. Renner. I'm going to ask Jim Ryman next to testify. Jim Ryman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Jim Ryman. I'm here representing the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association. We're a professional association of more than 700 members, mostly clinic administrators, representing the medical practices across Minnesota. We strongly support Senate File 1824. If nothing else, just to review the public program contracts between the Department of Human Services and the health plans. Now, annually, DHS has negotiated and awarded increases to the health plans, and it's normally on a PMPM, per member per month, and these increases have gone through. Since 1998, and we've met with some of the senators here, and we always show this chart. And I can make sure you all get a copy if you haven't received one, but it shows the increases that are going to the plans right there. Over the course of, since 1998, we're talking 118% more that they're being paid. At the same time, the specialists, as we try to balance the budget, have taken a 15% decrease. So when you look at this gap, over the past 14 years, we're talking 133% gap. And they're both going in the opposite way. We feel that if nothing else, if you do this audit, it will at least explain where did the money go to. Because it isn't going to the providers. It isn't going to the hospitals. It's not going to the physicians. And we need to find out where is this money going to. In response to a legislative auditor, the DHS officials stated that they rarely obtain information regarding health plan provider payment rates. And we found this when we were at least meeting with some of the senators and even representatives. The last 4 years when we met and we brought up this issue, we were told that they were under the assumption that when the health plan got an increase, some of that increase got passed on to us. I want to assure everyone in this room that's not the case. If anything, we've been getting decreases. And overall, a 15% decrease, and that's not even for the adjustment that the Department of Health did when they rebudgeted and reallocated the dollars on the MA fee schedule last year in January. So we've had a 15% decrease, and we just want to make sure everyone is aware of that. We've seen a lot of the articles in the last weekend, even in the Star Tribune and St. Paul Pioneer Press, and these published reports note that the health plan revenues from their public contracts even exceed their commercial contract revenue and have been deposited in growing reserves rather than going to pay for patient care or reinvesting in health care providers. So we just want to point out here that as long as that gap remains and no one knows where that money went to, there's no way we're ever going to solve this problem. Therefore, we believe that a thorough, no-holds-barred audit of the contracts between DHS and the health plans is greatly needed. We urge you to consider making such a requirement a session priority. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Ryman, to your knowledge, do the plans, are they audited right now?
They do file a report that's due April 1st. Now, what audit that report goes through, I'm not sure.
So, okay.
So on an annual basis, they do file a report to the state.
But to your knowledge, they're not audited? Is that sort of your testimony?
Well, as far as I'm aware of, I know it isn't an independent audit. I do believe that the Department of Human Services does review the report that they're received. I don't know if that's considered an official audit or not.
All right. To your point that you're making that is similar to the previous two testifiers, the problem is, and I think most people would agree, that the Medicaid structures really don't pay the costs as they are in existence in the professions, and that the plans make their reimbursements based on those costs. And so I just want to make sure I understand your argument is that the bill would require some scrutiny that would uncover where the money is going if it isn't going to you. And do you have a presumption of where that money is going?
No, I do not. I don't claim to know exactly where that money has gone to. It, to me, it's just a very strange that there would be those type of increases over a 14-year period. The plans are paying the provider network, the people that actually provide the services, less, and yet there's nobody questioning where are these dollars going to. If nothing else, I think this audit would look into that and at least answer a lot of the questions of folks wondering where is the money going to.
Are there other questions for the witness? Thank you. Twyla Brace. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I have talked with Senator Nino about his bill, and initially I just want you to know that I had supported parts of it for the accountability, and we had thought it might be a good idea, but we've looked into it and considered the words. And so I think what I just want to say before I go into the actual bill is just to say that we are well aware of the 1992 Health Right Law. And the Health Right Law is really what got us into the situation that we are today, which is that a few health plans have the entire market in Minnesota. Perhaps you know that there's about 220 health insurers that are actually listed as part of selling health insurance in Minnesota. But after Health Right passed and essentially changed the entire health insurance market, most of those plans no longer sell insurance anymore. And so we have a very closed market. We don't actually consider it really a market at all. And so I just want to start with that information before I just talk about the bill. And as I said initially, we like the idea to bring accountability, except we've never liked the encounter data part, which I'll talk about in a moment. But after reading the language, we're concerned. True accountability comes from individuals being able to not choose someone who's doing wrong things, bad things, someone you might think is doing fraud or not being accountable at all. But we don't really have an option, as I said, because essentially most of the health insurance companies we once had no longer serve or are open for business in Minnesota. Competition encourages good behavior because no one has to buy from someone they don't like. We understand the concerns of the bill supporters, but we believe that this bill will meld health plans with government for control over all insurance far into the future. There's been a lot of talk about data, and data is a tool of control when it's in the government's hands. And in that vein, I want to share three specific concerns. So first, we don't support the 2008 encounter data law, which is forcing insurers to send our medical data to a government for inspection and research. That was 2008. That database is located in the state of Maine, and we don't have any choice. Second, making access to this data real-time on line 3.8 of this bill could turn, we believe, into real-time rationing as the federal government tries to add millions more to Medicaid. And third, the statement on line 3.15 about unlimited government access to any and all data required is not the kind of authority government should ever have over industry in a free society, even if you don't like what the industry is currently doing. So what to do instead? We'd like to remove the not-for-profit HMO mandate that's here in Minnesota. We'd like to open the market to all types of insurance in and outside of Minnesota. We'd like to find contribution plans and vouchers, and we'd like all impediments to competition to be removed to make insurance more affordable. There are cheaper and less bureaucratic ways to care for the truly needy. It's not about covering everyone. It's about giving care to those who need it. We envision a future of real health insurance, not prepaid health care through managed care plans. We envision inexpensive catastrophic policies, the use of charity, medical sharing organizations, fraternal groups, free clinics, charity hospitals, and other options, such as something you may never have heard of, noinsurancesurgery.com. All of these should be available to compete for all 5 million Minnesotans. We believe this bill might get in the way of that kind of competitive future.
Thank you. Are there questions for the witness? Thank you. Before we have our next testifier, I did want to ask Sir Nino, just to the point that Ms. Brace was raising about the encounter data. And this, members, if you look in the bill, paragraph F, I think it's page 3, line 7 to 12. And I just wanted to find out, Sir Nino, I know that the plans are already required to submit a lot of data to the department. Is this anticipating that there would be additional data that isn't supplied to be provided? I'm just to try to understand more clearly what it is that we're requesting the plans to provide and how it may differ from what they're currently providing.
Mr. Chair, I and certainly representatives of the plans could speak to this as to what, from their perspective, I would not envision that this would be anything different than what they are reporting now. Simply, it's just clarifying that we would be able to get access to it. Obviously, at HIPAA compliant and all of that, obviously. Currently, they do, and Ms. Bray's referred to this, currently they do report data. It is collected periodically, I believe quarterly, if I'm not mistaken. And this would change the timing of that, clearly, to be as quickly as possible, as opposed to these batches that are sent over. But I don't think that this would require anything over and above what theoretically is being reported now.
Well, and thank you. I guess my understanding is they report data on a monthly basis, the encounter data. I was questioning a little bit about what granular and source level means, and I was trying to understand if what we're asking for in paragraph F is something different, or if it's your expectation that this be the same that they're currently reporting it, but just doing it daily, I suppose, would be the, I'm not sure exactly what the real time parameter would imply, but is that really the only issue that you're raising? Is not that they're not providing data, but it just, if it's happening once a month, it needs to happen more frequently, or just trying to understand what the point here is.
Mr. Chair, as to the specific question of would this require anything differently than what they're reporting now, I suppose the plans would be best to answer that and tell you what they think, but clearly it changes the timing.
Okay. Members, we are going to have to exit the room here in a few minutes, but I do want to, we've got some additional people that have asked to testify, and I'd like to ask Jeff Bartsch to come forward. Maybe he can help us with the question we've just been raising.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bartsch. I represent Medica. Medica is a nonprofit health insurer in Minnesota. We provide and administer benefits to about 1.6 million members, mostly in Minnesota. That includes individual, small group insurance, large group self-insured, and also the state's Medicaid program. I'm also here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Mr. Chairman, the Minnesota HMOs have been a valuable partner to the state for the administration of the Medicaid program for a number of years. We've brought in access, stability, and better outcomes to this population. There are over 500,000 public program enrollees right now who get their services through the managed care plans. And the state pays the HMOs about $3.5 billion for these services. So they are extremely large contracts, and they do require accountability and oversight. We certainly agree. Let me give you a quick background on some of the audits and other information that we currently provide. And I do have one handout. I apologize. I didn't get this to the committee ahead of time. We are currently audited by multiple entities. Every year, the HMOs undergo an independent audit of our financial statement. This is done by an independent certified public accountant. This information includes revenue, expenses, healthcare expenses versus administrative expenses by product line. So, for example, the Medicaid program, the Minnesota Care program, the senior programs, the disability program, et cetera. In addition to that annual statement, which is publicly available for people to review, we're also audited by multiple state and federal agencies, the Department of Health, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Human Services, and quite frankly, in addition to the scheduled audits, the Department of Commerce, either by themselves or at the direction of the Department of Human Services, can come on over and knock on the door anytime they choose to take a look at the financial information and make sure that everything is where it needs to be. The question about the encounter data, the HMOs currently do submit granular level encounter data to the Department of Human Services for the Medicaid population. We do so monthly. The encounter data we submit tells the Department of Human Services every time a provider sees one of our Medicaid enrollees, both what the provider bills us and what we pay. And that information includes who the enrollee is, who the provider was, where the service took place, what the specific treatment or diagnosis code was, how much was billed for the service, and how much was paid for the service. And every entity involved in that encounter gets a copy of both of those things, what was billed and what was paid. So the provider has both of those pieces of information. The health plan has both of those pieces of information. The Department of Human Services has both of those pieces of information. Now, it's important that everyone that's involved in that encounter has that information, and all pieces do. But we also want to make sure that that information or some of the specific and personal information that's included in it stays with those entities and responsible. This is personal information. Obviously, the state as the payer and the administrator has the right to acknowledge that. It helps them to administer the programs as well. The state also has the right to know, as they do collect now, what I as Medica specifically paid to Bob the dentist. What isn't appropriate to share publicly is what I, Medica, pay Bob the dentist. We don't want to share that with Doug the dentist. We also don't want to share that with Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Anytime you're sharing information about those specific contract rates to entities that aren't involved, you create the ability for someone not involved in that transaction to use the information to inflate rates. It's why I don't get to know what Blue Cross Health Partners and UCare pay their providers. And that's a good protection for everyone to have. So while it's important for the state, the providers, and the plans all to have access for that information, and quite frankly for the legislature to have as detailed of aggregate information about that as they can get to help you all manage the programs, we do want to make sure that those protections are in place as they currently are today to make sure, one, personal information is protected, and two, that we're not giving out market information that isn't responsible.
Could I just interrupt you for just 1 second on this point, Mr. Barch? I just want to be clear that if you look at paragraph F in the bill, would you read that to say that the data being requested in this bill is already provided by the plans to the department? Is there anything in this section that you read that would ask for additional information that is not already provided?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I believe the information itself is currently reported. I think the difference would be the requirement that this be a real-time submission of data. I don't know that the department could handle a real-time submission of data or what the cost to implement that would be. I also don't know what auditable proof that the encounters and claims are occurring, what different information that would be. Right now, as I mentioned, all the entities that are involved in the transaction have a copy of it. The department could certainly audit our databases to make sure that there's, you know, compliance in terms of what we have and what they get. They could do chart audits of the providers to make sure that what the providers are billing are what we're getting and paying out. Beyond that, I just don't know the clarification term around what auditable proof that the claims are occurring is.
And thank you. I just so right now, the information that if my neighbor is on a public plan and they go to the doctor at some point within the month, the Department of Human Services is going to get a report from you to show who that person saw as a provider, what the diagnosis of that condition was, what the outcome of that, all that very personal, private data is already provided to the department. And I think that was one of the things Ms. Braze was a moment ago raising as a question. But you're required to do that. We require that currently. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
And that is not public data, and that should not be public data. And that's, Senator Nino, correct me if I'm wrong, that's not your intent to make any of that information public. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. But that we do provide that. And then you summarize that for public consumption, I guess, in some ways. Is that what you're getting at by aggregating data? Could you just talk about that?
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Human Services, once they have all of that encounter data down to a personal level, have the ability to aggregate it or report on it in a manner that makes it non-personal, but that gives all of you potentially the information about utilization, aggregate payment rates, et cetera, as you make your determinations about how to help them manage the programs.
The second thing that you raised was the data whereby you report what you pay Bob the dentist and what you pay Doug the dentist, and you may pay them differently for the same procedure, and that may be, well, first of all, what would be the reasons why you would pay them differently?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, two reasons. The first reason would be, like any market negotiation, particularly with large providers, we'll negotiate rates that meet their terms and our terms. That includes both commercial rates and Medicaid rates. The other reason, particularly when it comes to the Medicaid program, is often we'll pay higher rates to providers that we need to assure access to. In Medicaid's case, primary care providers, particularly mental health practitioners, and dentists. Mr. Spizzetto commented that the dental fee schedule is very low. It is. There are a number of dental providers who get quite a large increase from the Medicaid fee schedule in order to make sure that not only they're in the network, but they're getting the revenue necessary to conduct their business for the Medicaid population.
And the department gets that data. They know what Bob the dentist gets paid by you for procedure X, and they know what Doug the dentist gets for the same procedure paid by you, and it may be different. The department gets that information currently.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
And that is not public information either. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chairman, that is not public information.
And, Senator Nino, your bill wouldn't call, or does it call, for that information to become public information?
No, Mr. Chairman, there's nothing in, as I read the bill, there's nothing in here that would change that.
Okay. And, Senator Nino, just Mr. Bartsch is the line 3.11 and 3.112, auditable proof that the encounters and claims are occurring as reported. What is that we're trying to get at with that? Can you speak to that just briefly so we know what we're going for here?
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's legalese for saying we just need to have some verification that the data you gave us is legit. What that specifically entails, I'm not sure, but that is what that is getting at, is that there's some verification that we're getting legitimate data from things that have actually occurred. I don't know if Senate Council is able to expand on that. I did not create this particular language. We have people that are much more lawyerly than me in the revisor's office and such that put together this language, but that is what that's getting at.
Okay. And Mr. Bartsch, you gave us a copy of this grid of a number of different audit procedures that are required by law that the plans go through. Do any of these audits provide proof that what is being reported is in fact happening? I mean, that seems to be the question raised, that we want to know that if you say something happened, is there any audit that's currently done that tries to get at that and verify that what is being claimed is actually occurring?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the annual financial statement that, again, we submit to the state after it's been independently audited, does account for and make sure that our accounting practices in terms of where we classify expenditures to administration, healthcare expenses, everything else, are in line. And so they do an independent audit of that information. Specifically to the claims and encounter data, again, every party involved in that encounter has a copy of both sides of that transaction to assure that it's taking place.
And I apologize for interrupting you. You're in the middle of your presentation, and I do want to continue that, but we are almost at our time that we need to recess. I did want to recognize that the commissioner is here from the department, and I don't know if you are going to be here this evening or could be here, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I thought you were here if you wanted to make any comments, or we can wait and hear later. So are you willing to come back to this evening, or did you want to make any comments right now? Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. Well, why don't we? Senator Marty has a question, so let's take his question. And if you're able to come back, then if we need to ask you questions, we'll do that then. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I am actually going to be gone for a couple hours this evening. Okay. So I have another committee at the same time as well. So I just wanted to make a couple of comments. One, I think Mr. Ryman's comments earlier were exactly right. We keep putting more money in, and the providers keep saying we're not getting it. And I remember a number of times over the years we've increased funding in order to pay the providers more, and they keep saying they don't get it. And I really became concerned about this about 2010 when one of our colleagues had a bill Similar to this, it also had medical loss ratios in for the plans. So they'd have to spend X amount of their budget on health care rather than on administrative and other costs. And the fiscal note from DHS at that time came back with the thing saying that wouldn't save the state any money because the way we pay them, basically if one of them didn't meet the loss ratio and had to refund $10, $20, $30 million the state, next year's rates would have to be bumped by $10, $20, $30 million to pay them back. So we have to pay even their fines and penalties, which suggested that the state's system for doing this is a very poor one. And I think Senator Nino's bill is trying to, it's not going to solve all the problems, but at least when we're dealing with $3 billion plus per year, somebody ought to audit it in a totally neutral manner, and I think that that's why this is so important. It's not really a question for Senator Nino. It's just a comment that I think this is a good start. And everybody says they're willing to have a good audit. This is a good, clean audit, so I hope we can do it.
Before we recess, is there any other questions that we have right now? I hope that you'll be able to return after our break, and I guess we do have a floor session somehow kind of interfere with our business here tonight as well. So I appreciate your willingness to testify, and we will come back at 6 o'clock and reconvene. Thank you. In room 15.